It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
Where the pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself in a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum of the Weefly, number 8. And this week we begin with one of the more colourful characters in English football, Jose Mourinho. Listen to what he says about himself.
I am the manager of one of the greatest clubs in the world, but I'm also one of the greatest managers in the world. I had great success last season. That's what probably you don't want to admit. And you do what you want. I do what I want. I analyze my performance myself. And for me, it's more important what I think than what you think. Two seasons ago, we had a fantastic season by winning the Europa League. We are the last team in England to win an European competition. And last season, I repeat, I won 8 titles. I won 8 titles. I am the only manager in the world that won Italy, Spain, and England. And by winning 8 titles, not small titles, not small countries, 8 proper titles, my second position last season is one of my greatest achievements in football. I think and I say, you disagree. You have the right to disagree. No problem for me.
Such humility. I find it utterly astonishing that within a week of saying that, he is supposed to go to jail for a year for tax evasion and fraud. He's going to get away with that. He's going to have to pay over £1 million fine. It just strikes me the arrogance involved there. Unlike, I guess people would want to say all football managers are arrogant. Well, I've been a football chaplain, and I don't think that's the case. I'm quite amused by Jurgen Klopp, who's a professing Christian. He seems to be a lot more self-effacing. But Mourinho, yeah, he thinks he's the greatest, and he thinks really only his opinion matters. In one sense, he just exemplifies the human disease of pride, but at maybe perhaps a much magnified level. Now, we have a number of stories concerning the transgender madness that's going on in our culture. I put an article on the blog, which is really quite astonishing because it comes from the British Association of Counselors and Psychotherapists. And they have argued that let me just repeat this sentence. I won't give you the whole article. They've said this: it's important not to assume being a woman necessarily involves being able to bear children or having XX sex chromosomes, i.e. female, or breasts. Just in what world does that sentence make any sense? But I'm afraid that is where we are at in our culture. Here's something that's happening. Misogynists, those who hate women or dislike women or despise women, are really lined up with transgender. How is that the case? I think it was Spiked Online said that transgender is really misogynism in drag. But that particular article in which the counselors are giving advice to people, this is how you counsel people. Did you know that being a man means that you are, quote, competitive, ambitious, independent, rational, tough, sexual, confident, dominant, taking risks and caring about your work? Being a woman means that you are nurturing, caring, social, emotional, vulnerable, and concerned with appearance. Yeah, that is coming in this manual, this advice. Now, it's the kind of sexist gendering that I would expect in, you know, maybe some more 1950s quaint books or something. But this is coming because of transgender, and that's why there's this ongoing fuss. Now, we see this in another place. Here's the story, and I'll keep it simple. Amy Challoner was a Green candidate, and her father was found to be guilty of child rape, really vicious and horrible. When he was accused, she still appointed him as her election agent. Now, she was also the vice chairman of the Green Party, and she has since stepped down. Caroline Lucas, the co-leader of the Green Party, actually spoke in defense of her. She, of course, did not speak in defense of her father, but she spoke in defense of her, and she queried whether people were being transphobic because Amy is a man who now says that they are a woman. Let's summarize it in this way. A politician stood for public office knowing her election agent was awaiting trial for the rape and torture of a young girl. That politician, as this article in The Spectator says, also advocated a policy that some people fear could make it easier for sexual predators to get access to girls. Now, I honestly believe that if Amy Chandler had been anything other than a trans activist, Caroline Lucas would not have defended her and would not have stood up for her. But little has that helped Caroline, because she has now been placed on the hate list for trans activists. And here's how that happened. Some Green activists suggested that Caroline should be involved or at least meet with or listen to a Women's Place UK, WPUK, who are a group of mostly left-wing women who organise public meetings to discuss gender law. Now, they are considered by the trans activists to be TERFs, trans-exclusionary radical feminists. Even by agreeing to meet with them, Caroline Lucas has placed herself on the hate list. Even Amy Chandler announced she was resigning from the Green Party and saying that it now had a significant transphobia problem. Seriously, this is how mad it's getting. And we're not finished yet.
I, you, he, she, it.
It's Freshers' Week. And that means up here in Scotland anyway, it's time that students head off to university. And at Edinburgh University, the Students' Association are providing a helpful guide and offering badges to people that they can identify the pronouns with which they wish to be used. He, if you look like me.
He is a caring father.
She, if you look like my wife.
She is a beautiful woman.
They've also got another one. They. Would you like to be called they? I think by the time you include all the pronouns, it's going to be a pretty big badge. But again, that's the crazy world we're living in.
He is a handsome man.
And lastly, in this particular area, an 81-year-old man has been granted transgender surgery on the NHS at 81 years old. And the BBC, of course, have made a programme saying how wonderful it is. And I think of all the people who are suffering because we do not have enough funds to adequately provide a proper, competent NHS. Madness doesn't even begin to describe it. Actually, I was going to say that was the end of the transgender discussion because I wanted to move on to a thing on censorship. But of course, again, it's tied in with transgender. And the story here is about Brown University. Now, what have Brown University done? Brown University in the United States. They had a research project, which was by a woman called Lisa Littman. And it was about transgender research. It was about whether some young people, some teenagers, some young girls in particular, were feeling social pressure to announce that they were transgender. It was entitled Social and Peer Contagion, or rather it concluded that social and peer contagion was a plausible explanation for cluster outbreaks. And again, it's just the influence that social media and friendship is having. Now, I would say it's pretty incontrovertible, but nonetheless, this is serious research that has been done. It's been peer-reviewed and so on. So what did Brown University do? Here's the announcement. The School of Public Health has heard from Brown community members expressing concerns that the conclusions of the study could be used to discredit efforts to support transgender youth and invalidate the perspectives of members of the transgender community. So, research which goes against the politics of one particular group is to be suppressed because it might invalidate their particular viewpoint. Now again, I'm not even sure where I would begin to comment on that. Even just to state it indicates how mad things have become. People are not interested in science or empirical research anymore. It's always just about the one agenda. Now, let me tell you a story. A girl, a schoolgirl, who has a party in her home and turns up at this home, and it turns out that her friends who come, her school pals, are all wearing shirts saying support same-sex marriage. What does that have to do with this party, or what does that have to do with this girl? They know that she's a Christian and they know that she's opposed to same-sex marriage. And so they are seeking to intimidate her. The Daily Mail has this headline: Christians are turning to homeschooling amid a massive rise in religious bullying, with some kids targeted for opposing same-sex marriage. That is happening. There's one horrific example given of a teacher asking those who are against same-sex marriage to stand up in front of their classmates. The bullying. Yes, there is homophobia within schools amongst pupils. We know that. We know that many times because the gay lobby keep telling us that is the case and keep getting more and more money to combat it. But I will almost guarantee you that you are far more likely to be bullied because you're a practicing Christian, and to be bullied by staff as well as by other pupils, than because you are gay. That's seen not only in schools, that's seen also in workplaces. I'm getting more and more stories from people who are getting increasingly scared, whether they're working in care, whether they're working in offices, whether they're working in companies. They're getting scared to express any kind of opinion. People bring up opinions to them and people ask them. For example, I can think of one workplace where they decided to have a trans awareness week. Now, there are no trans people in their workplace. None of them work with any trans people. They never come across any trans people in their workplace. So why is that happening? Again, it's partly virtue signaling, isn't it? But it's also a kind of way of saying, look, we're on the ball, and so on. And it's, again, incredibly intimidatory. As Christians, we have to respond to this and react with salt and light, with grace and truth, but never back down from what is true. Our society is heading down this insane route, and it's going to be too late for us when it all completely collapses. We need to be helping and encouraging and warning and challenging and questioning with the truth of Jesus Christ as we seek to be that salt and light. Let's do a wee bit of theology for a change. I've always had a number of people who listen to this podcast from Elevation Church because of a review that I wrote about the church. Now, I'm not in principle opposed to mega churches, nor am I opposed to some of the practices, although I personally may not like them. And there may be theological differences which you can put up with, but some of these churches, they are ridiculous. They border just on entertainment. And we need to be really careful about their influence. And one of them is Stephen Furtick's church, Elevation Church. Now, I came across a sermon he gave recently, and I found this quite fascinating because people thought this was incredibly profound.
The power of God was in Jesus. The healing power of God. The restoring power of God. The same power that made demons flee was in Nazareth, but Jesus could not release it because it was trapped in their unbelief.
He's talking about Jesus being unable to do something there in a place because of people's unbelief. And he extrapolates from that one story to say that Jesus is limited and cannot do things by our unbelief.
And there's one thing that even Jesus can't do. One thing that even the Son of God can't do. Even Jesus cannot override your unbelief. I see y'all looking at me like, is that true? Thought he could do anything. He said he could not. He wanted to. He was prepared to. He was able to. And he couldn't. The power of God was in Nazareth, but it was trapped in their perspective.
Now, to some extent, there's an element of truth in that. But to the extent to which he pushes it makes it incredibly dangerous. Because it's basically saying Jesus is powerless to change the heart of stone. Because that's what we have. We are dead in sins and trespasses. And we can't change that. And I do find people think that Furtick's message is profound, they think it's powerful, they think it's enabling. I think it's shallow. I think it's disabling. And I think it's incredibly weak. The right Christian attitude in this is surely to call people to repent, to call people to believe in Jesus, but to recognize that unless they are born from above by the Holy Spirit, they won't even be able to see that kingdom. It's not just what I would call the social heresies that are dangerous to our church. It's also the theological ones. It's also the ones in which the gospel is misrepresented. And Mr. Furtick's view, I'm afraid, it is a misrepresentation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't believe in a Jesus who can't change people's hearts. I believe he can, and I believe he does. And that's why it's as important, if not more so, to pray for people as well as talk to them about Jesus. And finally, I leave you with our quote of the week, and it's from John Gray's Seven Types of Atheism, which is a fascinating but also depressing book. But I find it completely fascinating. But here's the one quote. Racism and anti-Semitism, again, greatly in the news because of the Labour Party here in the United Kingdom. Racism and anti-Semitism are not incidental defects in Enlightenment thinking. They flow from some of the Enlightenment's central beliefs. Now, Steven Pinker and Richard Dawkins and most secular humanists are going to tell you that racism and anti-Semitism flow out of religion, and it's the Enlightenment that rescued us. But John Gray, the atheist philosopher John Gray, I think rightly, points out that racism and anti-Semitism are implicit in some of the Enlightenment's values. And I hope that you will be able to see that and to grasp. Oh, actually, I'm not going to say goodbye to you, because tied in with that, and I'm just going to mention this so that you can have a look at the article, but Theresa May giving 200 million to at least partially help fund abortions in Africa. That is breathtaking. British taxpayers' money being sent. It's classic Western Enlightenment liberal imperialism. It's the classic view of, I think, imposing Western values upon a culture which we think is somewhat backward. But let me leave you with this thought. Maybe John Gray is right. Maybe we are the ones who are backward. Maybe we are not progressive. We are regressive. And maybe it's the Africans who have a lot more to teach us. We need more humility. And how embarrassing, how absolutely embarrassing that a British conservative prime minister exults and rejoices in giving money to kill African children in the womb. And on that somber thought, we'll leave you for next week. We thank God that he is on the throne, and I will see you then. Bye. Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they get attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian.
to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens, trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.